August 15th, 1985, I'm at the home of Ernesto and Lourdes Pichardo in Miami Beach.
Unfortunately, we have to hold this thing up near us when we're talking to hear what's going on.
All right.
All right, so we're going to have to pass it back and forth.
Back and forth.
Yeah. Okay, let's see. Oh, okay. Okay, so we were just talking about the dances don't necessarily have anything to do with possession states. So I was going to ask, how are the dances related, or are they different than kinds of dances outside of Santeria? Or I have no idea what's going on with this stuff.
Dances. Dances go back to a mixture between the particular clothing and colors and styles that are traditional within the practice and the religion. Each deity has particular colors and clothing that is done, which relates to the particular, also the particular dances. Each Orisha has a particular form of dance, which is not directly interrelated with possession. Each rhythm, since we have two major forms of drum ceremonies, the rhythm patterns vary one from another. As we were talking a little while ago about the Guido, which is the informal party form of drum. And then we have the bata, which is the sacred and, of course, the major ritual type of drum. And so the dances are going to vary a little bit, not much, but will vary a little bit due to the tones that one system produces versus the other. So each Orisha has their own particular characteristics in dances and clothing. All right, they're not identical. A possession, as we were saying, can come upon any individual at any given point in time, regardless whether the presence of drums or rituals. We could be sitting here right now, and someone could be possessed. It has nothing, you know, you don't have to be under a formal religious context for something like that to happen. It's more on a necessity that is produced by it.
So when you're saying formal and informal, do you mean then that when people get together with it, like with a Huero ensemble, that, I mean, is essentially just a bunch of people getting together, I mean, to have a party, or is there some kind of at least minor, you know, religious undertone to it? I mean, would this be the same as a bunch of Presbyterians getting together to play volleyball?
Great example. do they? I don't know. the Guido is what we call the, in translation, would be the gourds, the African gourds, that only require one drum plus two or three gourds going on at the same time. So it's the rhythm of that rather than anything else. It becomes informal because it's used mainly to honor a particular deity that conceives something in particular. So it becomes a party-oriented. Although it does have a minor religious undertone to it, because there's always going to you're always going to do an altar to the in homage to the Orisha that conceived this particular wish or whatever it is the person was asking for, and it becomes informal because those objects of drums and the actual objects that are used for the music are not sacred in any form. versus the bata drums, which of course take months in the making, and each step is very ritualistic. Okay, and they have to be particular woods, and they have to be the wood has to be cut at a particular point in time during the year. And the process of cutting through them so that you can get the right tones are also quite ritualistically oriented. So the types of skins that you're using, those are animals that are used in offerings first, and then the skins are processed, and then they become part of that drum also. So they're very, very intermingled with the particular deities that rule the drum. You see? So there's your two biggest differences between one drum system and the other. Although the chants that are used are usually... in Bata, you usually have a series of chants that are more on the prayer-oriented. And then just chants, and then you get into just outright songs that you could use quite informally, versus what the Guido does, which is more of a party type songs. Of course, you're always singing to the deities, but even the songs that are used are on informal. You don't go into these deep prayers or anything like that during it. So those are the major differences between one and the other.
So would like... would like... Do you want to? So would like a bata be appropriate for something like an initiation, and maybe a wiro at something like occasion like I've heard of people sort of on the birthday of their initiation, you know, having like a big, I mean, you know, a party or something like that.
Guido could it would be more of the celebrating type versus the bata, which of course would be more ritualistic. It involves the participation of people within a particular context that isn't identical. It's not as rich, you know. It's more ritualistic than the celebration type of the Guido.
So I was going to ask you to go on, tell us about Santería in a nutshell. I think people might be interested in hearing a little bit about the structure, the basic structure of the religion, if it's possible to, you know, to do it in any short length of time. Maybe going over things like whether or not there's a hierarchy, you know, maybe different kinds of levels, the difference between Ifa and Babalao. Am I really confusing things? Or?
Sort of. We have, first of all, let's get a little bit, very briefly, on where it comes from, because the religion takes another name, which is Santería, because of the Caribbean experience. It comes from what's known today of southwestern Nigeria, from the Yoruba peoples. It travels to Cuba through the slave trade in large numbers, large enough where the practice was overwhelming versus the other African peoples, different areas that were in Cuba. So in numbers, the Yoruba were, of course, in numbers much larger than the rest of the areas that came in. Because of the political and religious interest of Spain and Catholicism, during, of course, the economic period of the slave trade, forces the Africans to hide behind Catholicism. In fact, at one point in time, Cuba's had that one of the two major aspects that they were looking to free a slave was first his Catholic status, and of course is his political status that they were looking at, if he had changed his views, if he had left Africa behind. So it was, you had an intense oppression in that sense. So one interesting thing is where the name Santeria comes from, and it develops really in around the Inquisition period, where the Catholic clergy applied that term in the dictionaries for the first time, meaning anyone who would be practicing or worshiping the Catholic images, the saints themselves, in an unorthodox manner, contrary to what the church would be saying at that point in time, was then called a santero and was persecuted. Okay. Then you had the big old historical witch hunt. And that was all classified under two terms, of course, santero or santera, meaning female, and brujeria, the witchcraft. So everything was under those two terms. No, that developed strictly of Spain's own headaches with their own population. But then, of course, Cuba and most of the Caribbean was dominated at that point in time by Spain and by Catholicism. So, of course, that is just simply transmitted from one area to another. Of course, they had already enough experience or time to study some of the African beliefs, which they didn't understand, but they were pagan in that sense. So then it becomes quite political, what was legal and what was not legal in Cuba. So it turns out that in terms of physical survival, the slave in Cuba have to adopt a Catholic front in order to survive and to become freed. So what that did is that since the only outlets that were left to be freed were through a Catholic path that they had to follow, of course that hurt, in my opinion, a little bit of the practice. Because then you were forced to adopt certain things of Catholicism in order to survive. Although, behind the curtain, the African religion was still being practiced. But very quietly, they couldn't get caught. Okay, and that's what leads it to really to its survival. They never gave it up, really. They took the chance. So, what we have today is that by 1960, the practice had seeped through all social stratifications and had reached all the way into, actually even to the presidency, into government, being practiced by high government white officials. But since you had this social stigma behind it, it was to be black and primitive, then they would do this in secrecy, but they had their Africans or their descendants keeping watch religiously on them, what they were doing, and make sure everything was all right.
So the stories about Batista and Castro, are those based on truth, do you think?
Well, there's an awful lot of speculation on what Castro is and is not, but I know that Batista was a priest, for a fact. I don't know, there's an awful lot of stories about Castro, but nothing has been officially confirmed, not that I know of. So there's just an awful lot of speculation whether he does practice it or not. I do know that Castro did not oppress it, versus what he did to Catholicism. he did oppress Catholicism as soon as he took over. But then that would make sense because this religion is not really politically oriented. Whereas Catholicism, of course, was part of the state back then. And they've always had their clergy stuck very, very high into key positions. Very tied into politics. So he, to overthrow it, he would have to, of course, eliminate those people. I mean, that's just tactics in that sense. What has happened is that come the 1960s and you have the Cuban exile, and of course many practitioners came through, but as the adjusting period of that first influx in the States begins to adapt themselves to this type of environment, that also led to more and more to practice these religions, or this particular one, in a more open manner, because you didn't, even your social levels had been a bit altered once you made the transition here, which allowed it even further to seep through, or set in a different way, which is, of course, a more open way. People weren't embarrassed to let their neighbors know that they are what they are. The other phenomena that happens in the States is that that it becomes practiced by the majority of upper-class whites. It makes that transition also. So, why is that? Because we had in the 1960s, when Castro takes over, what comes over here, first of all, was predominantly that social class. And second of all, for some strange reason, you had very small group of black Cubans coming in that point in time, versus quite the contrary now during Mariel. It was the total opposite. Okay, so it's just a phenomenon of that transition that just went happen. You know, it just happened that way. You know, so I wouldn't say that it's more. What I would say is that what we do have here, of course, is that upper middle class here took on a more Anglo approach towards life, which was a more open, this is what I am, this is what I do, and that's it. And began to accept, take in a little more of the Anglo lifestyle and thought. That seeped in a little bit. So there's a lot of factors that contribute to that. These are just to mention a few that produced the openness. Now, what also produces the openness is that when you're dealing with upper class whites, shifting opinion and wanting and not, you know, being disturbed about practicing it, that pushes it out more and more on a visible, because it is no longer a social class that's oppressed. Now you're dealing with that middle, which has been educated academically, which does have either education or even a commercial background. You know, they begin to speak English and Spanish. Their children, you know, now we're talking the Anglo schooling. So you have all these generations, this whole readaptation period here that also pushes it out more and more out in the open. And becomes more and more acceptable in that sense, you see. Also, the Cuban society suffered from a bag full of hypocrisy, because since it was socially biased to practice it, yet people practiced it then in secrecy, because they didn't want to go into the social party on the weekend and have people knowing that they practice this so-called black primitive religion which was pagan according to Christian upbringing. So it really becomes quite hypocritical, because when they come here, then the Cubans start saying, hey, neighbor, cut it out, because we all know where we came from, and in Cuba we all used to do it in hiding, but there's no need to do that here. The other problem is that by the late 1960s is when the church, through Vatican II, goes into immense turmoil. And they're having all kinds of problems at the same time, handling themselves with the Hispanic clergy and having them to adjust. And they weren't addressing the population either. Okay, so they were in an adjusting period. So there's a lot of things that contribute to that factor, you see, that just went right through, which led to where we are today, really. And as far as its structure, that's exactly one of the things that we're going to be teaching now in the courses, which is to thoroughly examine and expose its hierarchy that you have in priesthood, and the divinities that we're worshiping, and what energies they represent or control, what kind of superficial involvement does a person have with those deities, and then again, what kind of personal experience do they have with these deities? So you have those two aspects that we're going to be examining. The other thing that we're going to be looking at, of course, is that it's quite elaborate, quite complex. It's not as simple as it appears to be. You see, once you hear an anthropologist begin to speak about it, they make it sound so easy. But there is so much behind all of that that, of course, take hours of explanation and understanding, you know, dialogue, to be able to really have people grasp exactly what we're talking about. But as far as how primitive or what, the other thing we must look at is that as far as we understand it, it is definitely a pre-Christ religion. We know that. How far back? I personally don't know that. But we do know for a fact that it's pre-Christ in any event. I believe that some of the archaeologists have dug up some stuff recently and have also confirmed that. I think so far, based on what they have found, it goes something like 2,000 years B.C. so far. So, and they're still working at it, of course. So, but we have our own central dogma, our own creation myth, our own everything, really. Including, of course, possession, divination, and all kinds of stuff. You know, one interesting point is that the most of the priesthood and the most active in the priesthood are women, priestesses. That's one interesting point. Women here have their own status per se. They're not like Catholicism, for instance, that the nun is quite restricted in her functions. Here is quite the contrary. Women initiate people into priesthood. Women have a large clientele that they deal with. Women get into all kinds of different phases of ritual that they're not prohibited to, you see. Women can get into divination if they wish, if they learn it. So they have a very highly active part in the whole role of it. Actually, Lourdes is going to be dealing with that in her class, because it's an interesting aspect. There's two priestly offices that they are on, until they lose their menstrual cycle, they cannot participate in. One is what I do, which is the Italero, which becomes a master of the major rituals like initiation rites and stuff like that. That because of certain things that we do in that category, women, until they don't lose their cycle, they can't participate of that. But of course, In fact, today in Miami, I think we have now like 2 women that are already taking that, holding that position now. So it's not that it doesn't exist. There's already 2 that have passed that. And of course, there's the Fa priesthood, the priest of Orumila, which is what he is, which of course is the highest priesthood, the highest level of priesthood. Then comes what I do, which is the Italero. That's the second position. And they become, of course, the master of divination. They become the master in preserving the knowledge of the major aspects of the practice. They hold that capacity, that knowledge. They contain it. They see to it. It's preserved and handed down. Okay? So, of course, they have their own place in the priesthood, which, of course, is strictly male. Okay? But they also have what they call the apetebis, which are really the assistants to the priests of Orumila, which serve that level of priesthood in many aspects. And they receive that orisha, in other words, but there are particular aspects of their own priest rites and stuff like that, initiation rites to that level of priesthood and so on, that they don't internally participate. But they have an awful lot of doing in the making of it, actually, in the preparation of it. Okay, so they're quite active outside of the internal ritual, per se. That's how that turns out. So there's always that presence of the women, highly involved in everything that's being done, you see. But there is a... And there, it is said that Africa, the African priests initiate women to that level of priesthood, which I have not confirmed that, and I find it hard to believe. Because, again, based on the types of things that they have to deal with, it would prohibit a woman, because of her menstrual cycle, to participate. So that's a contradiction in its statement. But I haven't been able to really sit down with an African Babalao priest and ask him how valid that statement is. But that's something that's going around. It's being said. Right. Little internal gossip.
So there is still quite a lot of similarity between the religions as it's practiced in the New World, let's say a Santeria, you know, or whatever, and the form or the path that it has taken in Africa. Have they remained pretty much the same?
Well, one of the things that shows a mild difference is that the Yoruba dialect that we preserve in ritual is archaic Yoruba versus what they have now, of course, which is that modern Yoruba. So we, in most part, can totally communicate, in most part, when we speak to each other. With certain, of course, certain words and so on that are altered in the meaning of it. Ritual-wise, there are some differences, don't forget that during the trade, slaves were whole tribes were taken into slavery. So there is knowledge that went to Cuba that by the time it got to Cuba was lost in Africa. And the same time, vice versa, there's knowledge that never made it to Cuba because it remained in Africa, because it was never enslaved. So we both on sides suffer from that. But I have done initiations with some of the African priests, and we have had no problem in understanding each other very quickly. So the relationship is very, very close, really. Very close. There's very little alterations, differences. But in theology-wise, I mean, we're still calling this the Orishas the same thing, and we're viewing them on the same terms. So there's no really practically no difference in that either. The main difference as far as Orisha is that some of these divinities never made it to Cuba. Priests of those deities never made it to Cuba. So Africa is said that Africa holds over 400 different deities, where in Cuba, I don't think we go past 30 that ever made it to Cuba. So there's a big difference in that sense, you see. And of course, some of the social customs were lost in Cuba. Socially religious oriented, okay, were lost. Rituals and stuff that were lost in that sense, because you couldn't do them. But a lot of these things are being restored. There's a big movement going on to restore what they lost and what we lost. And the only way you can restore that is by an even trade, you see. And that's been going on for quite a while now. Of course, we feel that no one, no matter how knowledgeable or how old they are in the priesthood, none of us become ever experts in what we're doing. So therefore, it becomes a daily learning and teaching experience on a daily basis. So there's always a trade going on, you see? And although we're not institutionalized, we do operate in a like a network, regardless. I mean, we know daily, more or less, who's going through what, because there is that modern thing called a telephone, and your tongue, yes, of course. So we're constantly doing an awful lot of talking back and forth and participating with other priests in their homes and so on. There's always rituals going on. So you're always circulating enough where it becomes a very quiet network, per se. It's not